The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
John Gibbons is with us for our weekly environment spot. Today is Earth Overshoot Day 2024. Hang on, have you not spoken to us about that already this year?
Good evening, Matt. Yeah, well spotted. We actually discussed this in the first week in May, because May the 2nd was Overshoot Day for Ireland, right? So basically, the Earth Overshoot Day is calculated on a global basis, and this year it falls on August the 1st, which is, of course, today. But obviously, individual countries have different impacts. So Ireland would be in the top, really, among the top impacts. So our Earth Overshoot Day for the year occurs on the 2nd of May. Essentially, Matt, what that means is that Ireland uses its fair share of the Earth's resources in the first 4 months of the year. And so essentially, were everyone to live the way people in Ireland live, in simple terms, we would need three planet Earths in order to sustain that. Now, for the world as a whole, we need approximately 1.7 planet Earths to maintain our habitability, let's say, based on our current consumption and so on. And as you probably noticed, Matt, we don't have either three planet Earths available. We don't even have 1.7. We've just got the one.
Okay. Tell us, how is the Olympics going when it comes to climate measures?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the news really from the Olympics this week is that, of course, Europe has been basking is the wrong word. Let's say suffering under really significant heatwave conditions, Matt. What they found, and this is what's called an attribution study done by a group called World Weather Attribution. So they're able to basically analyze extreme weather events in real time, so often within days or less. And what they've established basically is that the conditions now prevailing in Paris for the Olympics, they're about 3 degrees hotter than it would be if you took away the climate change signal. So they're basically saying that, you know, it's really pushing the Olympics and obviously many other parts of Europe into, you know, really extreme conditions. Now, this is hardly news to anybody. We're seeing this right across the Mediterranean region through July, Greece, Italy, Spain, Morocco, lots of people dying, heat waves are basically, outbreaks of fire and so on. In fact, we recorded 48 degrees centigrade, Matt, in Morocco recently. So essentially, as we've spoken about many times, the temperatures are being amped up by the underlying climate signal, and we're seeing that playing out and beginning to really impact events like the Olympics, which of course is a double-edged sword because, again, as we've spoken about before, these type of events also have a very significant carbon impact. So I suppose it's on both sides of the balance sheet, really.
So as we're getting the bad news out of the way first, let's talk about tea and coffee prices. You're predicting increases. Why?
Yeah, it looks that way, Matt. I mean, basically, again, this is not exactly shocking news, but it's coming through basically that we're seeing the global coffee supply is getting constrained because the countries, mostly in the tropical regions, that are main coffee producing countries, they're getting hit hard and early by climate impacts. And they do vary. Obviously, rising temperatures is leading to the desertification and the abandonment of some tea and coffee plantations. We've seen, for example, globally earlier this year, we've hit a 13-year high in coffee prices. The issue this time is they don't show any signs of coming down again because we're losing the types of... I mean, there's the areas where these can be produced are quite finite. And also, you do get surprises. So, for example, Brazil would be one of the world's largest coffee producers by some distance. And they've experienced frosts early in the season that led in 2021 to a 60% decline in coffee production. That, again, had a ripple effect of pushing up coffee prices around the world. We've similar issues with tea. And we're seeing, again, tea production, drought hitting tea production in certain countries by about 30%. And so overall, I mean, if you take tea and coffee together, we consume about 7.5 billion cups of tea and coffee every day, by the way. And in Ireland, where I think they reckon that about 78% of us drink at least one cup of coffee a day. So I mean, this isn't, you know, this is far more, to be honest with you, Matt, this is a far bigger threat to the people whose livelihoods depend on coffee production than it is to us having to deal with an extra 50 cent on our cup of coffee. But it's indicative, really, that food production around the world is becoming more difficult, more expensive as a result of rising temperatures and the increase in extreme weather events.
Okay, I want to give a little bit of time to something that may be positive, because John, you're probably aware a lot of people give out that you're all negativity, but tell me about something that sometime to say hopefully might be a potential game changer. The discovery of something called dark oxygen. Tell us about this.
Yeah. Yeah, this is extremely interesting. Well, the first thing I would say is that this is some deep sea scientific work. First of all, that was sponsored by deep sea mining companies. So they essentially paid a bunch of scientists to carry out investigative work in the deep ocean. The reason, of course, that the companies want to get down there is that there are a lot of metals. They're known as polymetallic nodules. These are sort of clumps of metal. They've been described, Matt, as potato-sized lumps of metal that are lying on the deep sea floor, and they're sort of amalgams of things like cobalt, nickel, copper, lithium, and manganese. And of course, these are valuable metals. So the mining companies, which obviously have already stripped much of the face of the earth looking for these materials, are now turning their gaze to the seafloor. And interestingly, the scientists that they commissioned to do this work, obviously they've identified where you'll find reserves of these metals. But along the way, the really interesting discovery, and that was published in one of the major Nature journals, is that these polymetallic nodules appear to be acting like deep sea batteries, right? So again, what we're looking at here is they're actually producing oxygen, because something that has puzzled scientists for a very long time is that in the very deep sea, the conditions should be anoxic. In other words, typically the only way that oxygen is produced on Earth, as we understood it, was by photosynthesis. So typically, trees, for example, produce oxygen as a result of absorbing sunlight and release oxygen through photosynthesis. We also know in the oceans that algae produce huge amounts of oxygen through photosynthesis. It was assumed, Matt, up until this work, that that's basically that's the basis for life on Earth. Now scientists are looking at this again and saying, hang on a second, it appears that in completely oxygen-free conditions, this is in the deep ocean where no light can penetrate, they were able to measure new oxygen being produced. And the thesis, if you like, that they're working on is that these electromagnetic nodules are acting like batteries. And you know, with a battery, when you put a current through a battery, basically among the things that it bubbles off is oxygen. So it appears at the very deep sea level that oxygen production as a biophysical process has been underway probably for millions, maybe hundreds.
Okay,
of years.
So does that then suggest that the miners want to extract these minerals and put them to use on the surface of the earth? Because even if they could be put to use, would that not do great damage to what goes down in the deep waters and have all sorts of unintended bad consequences?
Exactly. You put your finger on the button there. I mean, for example, there was an area in the ocean that was deep sea mined back in the 1980s. And marine biologists recently revisited that area. And what they discovered is that everything was dead. Not even bacteria had returned 40 years later. So what we now know from this is that when you deep sea mine, you cause irreparable harm, at least on the multi-decadal timescale. So I suppose the issue here, and this is the awkward bit for the mining companies that paid for this research, apparently they're quite upset about it, because the scientists are now saying what our research is telling us is we need to be super careful. You can't just treat the deep sea as if it's some kind of a quarry that we can go and take stuff from. And another issue, Matt, of course, is that seafloor also contains vast quantities of stored carbon. So as trillions of animals in the ocean, as they die and fall to the seafloor, that forms a deep layer of basically trapped carbon, which over time would ossify over a very long period. But deep sea mining operations are going to go down, a bit like a bottom trawling, and dig up and recirculate millions of tons, maybe billions of tons of this trapped CO2. So you have a double whammy here. First of all, we're disturbing a highly sensitive habitat. And number two, we're probably also going to involve into the bargain the release of huge amounts of additional carbon dioxide at a time when we really need to be getting this stuff out of the atmosphere, not putting it in.
Thank you very much, John Gibbons.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.